12. Unseen Worlds. In this chapter, we begin following the spirit molecule into more unexpected territory. This terrain is not so easy to recognize or understand because the experiences are less clearly related to the thoughts, feelings, and bodies of our volunteers. Rather, they suggest freestanding, independent levels of existence about which we are at most only dimly aware. These reports challenge our worldview, and they raise the emotional intensity of debate. Is it a dream? A hallucination? Or is it real? Where are these places, inside or out? These are some of the questions we'll begin pondering as we review the following reports. Volunteers have referred to these places already. Marcia journeyed to the Taj Mahal, and Cassandra was yanked into the crazy circus sideshow, full of clowns and other beings. In this chapter, I will focus on this issue of where. Where does DMT take us by the hand and lead us to? This is a necessary part of mapping the spirit molecule's territory. An interesting aspect to these reports is that they are mostly excerpts rather than records of entire sessions. Rarely did the DMT environment alone take center stage during someone's trip. Certainly, the spaces in which volunteers found themselves were highly unusual. However, more important was the meaning or the feeling, the information, associated with where they were. Of course, once other life forms began to appear in these spaces, it was difficult not to be completely swept up in their existence, and these reports, rightly, are the subject of separate chapters. Despite their strange nature, these excerpts are introductory. They set the stage for the next layer of existence to which the spirit molecule leads. Where is the backdrop, the scenery? Who gets to the core of these matters? But first, let's get acquainted with the landscape. At the most basic biological level was the perception of DNA and other biological components. Carl was our first dose-response study volunteer, DMT-1. He began speaking within 2 minutes of getting his first non-blind low dose. There were spirals of what looked like DNA, red and green. Philip, about whose harrowing 0.6 milligrams per kilogram experience we've already heard, also recognized the familiar double helix pattern, this time on his double-blind 0.4 milligrams per kilogram dose. The visuals were dropping back into tubes like protozoa, like the inside of a cell, seeing the DNA twirling and spiraling. They looked gelatin-like, like tubes inside which were cellular activities. It was like a microscopic view of them. Cleo, whose enlightenment experience we will discuss in a later chapter, also met up with visions of DNA. There was a spiral DNA-type thing made out of incredibly bright cubes. I felt the boxes at the same time that my consciousness shifted. We will closely examine Sarah's entity contact experience in a subsequent chapter. However, it's interesting to note her reference to DNA. I felt the DMT release my soul's energy and push it through the DNA. It's what happened when I lost my body. There were spirals that reminded me of things I've seen at Chaco Canyon. Maybe that was DNA. Maybe the ancients knew that. The DNA is backed into the universe like space travel. One needs to travel without one's body. It's ridiculous to think about space travel in little ships. Some subjects experienced a less obviously biological representation of information than DNA. Vladan, a 42-year-old Eastern European filmmaker, was one of our busiest research subjects. He volunteered for many of the pilot studies in which we worked out doses and combinations of medications to use with DMT. He also received more psilocybin in our preliminary dose-finding work than anyone else. On a relatively low dose of DMT, 0.1 milligram per kilogram, during the Pindalol study, he encountered symbols that were rich with meaning. There were visuals at the peak, soft and geometric. They were 3D circles and cones with shading. They moved a lot. It was almost like looking at an alphabet, but it wasn't English. It was like a fantasy alphabet, a cross between runes and Russian or Arabic writing. It felt like there was some information in it, like it was data. It wasn't just random. Later, while participating in a pilot ciproheptadine session, Vladin received 0.2 milligrams per kilogram DMT and again saw alphabet-like figures. Like seeing panels with a cut-out shape, rounded edges, hieroglyphics of some sort. They weren't painted on, but more cut out, through which I saw the colors. Another striking example of the visual transformation of language and numbers comes from Heather. At 27 years of age, she was one of our most experienced volunteers. Heather had taken psychedelics close to 200 times, had over a dozen experiences with smoked DMT, and was quite familiar with marijuana, stimulants, and MDMA. In addition, she had drunk the DMT-containing tea, ayahuasca, 10 times. Emerging from her first non-blind high dose of DMT, she began, "There was a woman speaking Spanish all the time throughout the trip. She had quite a unique accent. Maybe it wasn't Spanish, but it sounded like it. At one point she said, 'Regular.' She threw a white blanket over the scene and then pulled it back repeatedly. It was really weird. There were numbers. It was like numerology and language. There were all these colors, and then there were all these numbers, Roman numerals. The numbers became words. Where do words come from? The woman would cover them with her blanket, the words and the numbers. It started out typically as DMT, but then I went past it, beyond where I've been on DMT. There is that ringing sound as you're getting up there, and then I went to the language or number thing. It was totally inexplicable. Maybe it was trying to teach me something. The first number I saw was a 2, and I looked around and there were numbers all around. They were separate in their little boxes, and then the boxes would melt and the numbers would all merge together to make long numbers." Eli was a 38-year-old architect and one of our most fearless research subjects. He previously had regressed under LSD through childhood to a point where I was sitting above the room watching myself. During a 0.4 milligrams per kilogram dose that he received during the ciproheptadine study, he noted, "What's interesting is that I began experiencing sets of hallucinations, and then I said to myself, 'Ah, this is the logos. There's the blue-yellow core of meaning and semantics, basically.'" I laughed at his use of the word basically. "That's easy for you to say." "I know. It's like threads of words or DNA or something. They're all around there. They're everywhere. After the blue amoebic shapes, there were several pulsating places. I thought, there are lots of these. It's a good feeling. Then it breaks into a ruffled reality. When I looked around, it seemed like the meaning or symbols were there, some kind of core of reality where all meaning is stored. I burst into its main chamber." Trying to keep up with Eli, I wondered, "It seems like some kind of membrane you break through into a feeling of meaning and certainty." "It is. I don't know if it's because of my interest in computers or not, but it seems like it's the raw bits of reality. It's a lot more than only ones and zeros. It's a higher level. Very potent bits." Eli went on to describe the room into which he burst. "With this report, the view DMT provides now starts enlarging. I was in a white room, experiencing certain emotions and feelings that gave me an intense feeling of being a co-reality. Like a dream I had of bumping into some Hispanic kids with my car, into their car. They were really mad at me. I said to them, 'If you hate me, you hate yourself. Our cultures are merged, so there's no defending against that. Their culture, our culture, they were co-real, existing simultaneously. The white room consisted mostly of light and space. There were cubes stacked with icons on the surfaces, like a logos of consciousness. It was light, but there was a lot of other information coming in. Other volunteers found themselves in rooms that seemed like playrooms or nurseries, some sort of holding space made especially for them, full of meaning and depth. Gabe, a 33-year-old physician, lived and worked in a remote rural community. He was one of the few volunteers who previously had smoked DMT. After receiving 0.4 milligrams per kilogram DMT in combination with cyproheptadine, he reported the following. There were some scenes or forms like in a nursery. No babies, but there were cribs and different animals, vibrant. I went to a childhood scene or feeling. It was like I was in a stroller. Kid images. It was sort of scary. I can't describe it. I could draw it, maybe. It was like being in a room as a child with a stroller. There were cartoon-like people in the room, but they weren't what I wanted to see. Aaron was at the cutting edge of consciousness enhancement using legal technologies, electronics devices such as brainwave driving machines, supplements and vitamins, and Eastern spiritual disciplines. He was 46 years old when he started working with us. Aaron was one of the few Jewish volunteers in our study, and I felt a certain kinship with him at that level. He was hopeful but skeptical, looking forward to the experience, but praying he would survive intact. During his DMT plus Pindolol session, he beheld two elements of unseen worlds, the informational language aspect and the nursery playroom theme. There are no doors. There's nothing to go through. It's either over here, it's dark, or over there, there are images. You just can't do anything with them. It was Mayan hieroglyphics. It was interesting. The hieroglyphics turned into a room, like I was a child. There were toys there, like I was a kid. It was like that. It was cute. On a slightly larger scale, the spirit molecule led another volunteer to an apartment of sorts. Tyrone was 37 years old when he participated in the dose response study. He was a former student of mine, a junior psychiatrist I had supervised for a year. As he emerged from his double-blind 0.2 milligrams per kilogram dose of DMT, he reported, "It was a scene of apartments from the future." He laughed at how unexpected it was. Like living quarters. They were gorgeous. Pink, orange, those kinds of colors. Yellow, real bright. I asked, "How did you know they were of the future?" "The places to sit, do things, the counters. They were molded out of the walls. I've never seen anything like it. It was really modern looking. The almost organic nature of the apartment was beautiful. It wasn't just functional. There was life in the furniture, like it was molded out of something alive, an animal, a living being. I felt in awe of the apartments. An artistic appreciation, like looking at a beautiful painting and getting lost in it, lost in the happiness. At the end, I went past, beyond the apartments. I entered into a space, a crack in the earth. It wasn't horizontal. It was vertical. A crack in space." Aaron also participated in the EEG study. Several days after the session in which he received the 0.4 milligrams per kilogram DMT dose, he sent us handwritten notes that capture, better than mine, a description of where he went that day. Here we see some glimmerings of the inhabited nature of these strange spaces. There was no turning back. After a moment or two, I became aware of something happening to my left. I saw a psychedelic day-glow-colored space that approximated a room whose walls and floor had no clear separations or edges. It was throbbing and pulsing electrically. Rising in front of me was a podium-like table. It seemed that some presence was dealing, serving something to me. I wanted to know where I was and sensed the reply that I had no business there. The presence was not hostile, just somewhat annoyed and brusque. Philip's double-blind 0.4 milligrams per kilogram dose was definitely easier to negotiate than his 0.6 milligrams per kilogram overdose, and he remembered it well. In this session, the venue expands to include even larger-scale observations. The relentless, scratchy, crackling visuals didn't last long. Then I was above a strange landscape, like Earth, but very unearthly. Mountains of some sort. It was very friendly and inviting. It was so real, I had to open my eyes. When I did, the scene was overlaid on top of the room. I closed my eyes, and that removed the interference with what I had been seeing. It was like a super bright day glow poster, but much more complex. I was hovering miles above it. I had the very distinct sense of doing this, not just the visual perception. There were some telescopes or microwave dishes or water tower things with antennae on them. I wish I could take you by the hand and show you. A vast expanse of horizon. The sun was different, different colors and hues than our sun. Let's close this chapter with Sean's description of a DMT world that seemed much like our own. However, that world had nothing to do with Room 531, and there were people other than Laura and me inhabiting it. I like this example because it combines the material from this chapter with the one that follows. In other words, it is somewhere else with someone there and something happening, but so familiar as to deceive us about its otherness. We'll hear about Sean's enlightenment experience in greater detail later. However, for our purposes, what's interesting to note is what he told us after his third 0.3 milligrams per kilogram DMT session during the tolerance study. Almost as an afterthought, before we began his fourth and final dose, he said, "Oh yeah, there were people and guides. I was with a Mexican family on a porch of a house in the desert. There was a garden scene outside. There were kids and stuff. I was playing with the kids. I was part of the family. I had a sense of an old man standing behind me or around me someplace. I wanted to talk with him, but he let me know somehow that it was more important to visit with the young girl. It was pretty laid back, benign. It seemed so natural and complete as it was happening. It wasn't a dream at all, I thought. It seems like a pretty common day." And then I stopped and thought, "No, I'm tripping." There were some black people too, sort of pulling at me. There was a curious feeling of being extracted. It was a jarring feeling. I was being called away. Trying to keep his train of thought going, I suggested, "It sounds like something out of Carlos Castaneda's books." "It does, doesn't it?" "No, I hadn't thought of that." Perhaps you think these perceptions are not so strange after all. We all dream of unusual places and things. However, our volunteers not only saw these things, but felt an unshakable certainty that they actually were there. Opening their eyes at any time superimposed this reality with their now manifest but previously invisible one. Neither were they asleep. They were hyper-aware and awake, able to tell themselves to do things in this new space. It's amazing how often I heard them say, "I looked around and saw..." Listening to these experiences also began stretching my limits as a clinical psychiatrist and researcher. I made few comments regarding people's reports of these unseen realms. It was hard to keep up, and I didn't know what to say. It was at this point that I began having to fight a tendency to regard these stories as dreams or figments of their DMT-amplified imaginations. On the other hand, I also began doubting my own model for what exactly happens on DMT. Were people really somewhere else? What exactly were they witnessing? These are not trivial questions. As we saw in the previous chapter, sensitive, empathic, and encouraging responses are crucial in working with people under the influence of DMT. An offhanded, doubting, or skeptical remark could make someone feel badly and disregarded, which could rapidly lead to a negative or frightening outcome. We get an intimation of this in Sean's flat rejection of my suggestion that his Mexican family scene was based upon a memory of Carlos Castaneda books. He was with them. It wasn't something else. In addition to the need for close tracking and empathic responses to volunteers' experiences, I also needed to help them understand what had happened to them. When it came to the invisible landscape, we all faced more difficult challenges in making sense of what was going on. As we'll see in the next two chapters, this became an even more pressing issue when contact with beings predominated people's sessions.